colleague, Judge Richard Stearns from the District of Massachusetts, who's returned to be with us for this case, and we will call the case now, United States ex rel. Doe v. Heart Solution PC et al. Mr. Cedrone, am I saying your name right, sir?
Yes, you are. Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Cedrone. I represent appellants Nita Pinnell and Heart Solutions, Inc. In their appeal from the district court's erroneous grant of appellee's motion for summary judgment. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my 15 minutes for rebuttal, if that's acceptable.
Yes.
Okay. And I'm certainly prepared to provide a detailed recitation of the procedural history of this case.
Well, we're well familiar with that.
Given the court's two letters, that the court is intimately familiar with the procedural history, and I suspect that the court, given its directive, wants to jump right into the substance of their two letters.
Right. So why don't you take a look at page DA-44 in the appendix. This is in the excerpt that was provided to us of the plea colloquy, and I'll just quote it for you if you don't have that right handy.
I have it, sir.
This is the district court Judge Wallace, asking, and were your companies, BioSound Medical Services and Heart Solution PC, paid at least $1,668,954.95 by Medicare for claims submitted for diagnostic testing and reports that were never interpreted by a licensed physician, and diagnostic neurological testing that was never supervised by a licensed neurologist? Defendant, Ms. Patel, yes. Now, why isn't that admission all by itself not game up? Because that's a statement, and I don't think anybody's claimed there's something ambiguous about it, that down to the penny, that sum was paid for testing that was never interpreted by a licensed physician, for testing that was never supervised by a licensed neurologist.
Your Honor, and with all due respect, I do believe there was some ambiguity in that, because you can't look at that question simply in the light of back in the vacuum of the question. You have to look at it in the context of the whole plea colloquy. And
where's the confusion around those words? Where is in that question and that answer, is there any room for Ms. Patel to say, I didn't understand what you meant?
The confusion really is in the connecting of BioSound and Heart Solutions. And who she would not have had any civil exposure, at least that's the theory, from the False Claims Act, for unsupervised medical testing for the company that she didn't own.
I thought that she was charged and she pled not only to being to some sort of an owner responsibility, but in fact that it was acknowledged, maybe I'm wrong about this, that there was an aiding and abetting plea here as well.
Well, she was charged and pled guilty to the one count of health care fraud.
Yeah.
Right, and there
even going beyond that, is being an owner, is that a prerequisite? Is that an element of the claim?
It is not an element of the crime, or it's not necessary that she be an owner to assist, but it is my understanding that with respect to the unsupervised testing, that she could only be held liable under the False Claims Act by virtue of being an owner.
How so?
Where
does it say in the False Claims Act that you couldn't lie your head off if you're not an owner, but you still made a false claim? I mean, that's the assertion, not that she was the owner, but that she made a false claim.
Well, that she was aware of and maybe participated in assisting, not that she made a false claim. I mean, that's part of the problem here, is that the companies are making the false claims. Mr. Patel is making the false claims. She has knowledge of the false claims.
She's assisting in the false claims. She acknowledged and admitted that she was assisting in the false claims. That's clear in the colloquy, isn't it?
Your Honor, again, with all due respect, I don't think there's anything that's actually very clear in the colloquy. When you look at the entire colloquy and you see the confusion when they keep coupling the two companies together.
Well, that's true in certain questions, but not in the one that Judge Jordan just read.
Again, Your Honor, I don't believe it's fair to assess one question in a vacuum when we're talking about a whole set of facts and circumstances that sort of color, you know, the overall situation.
Well, taking it out of the context of simple question and answer in a plea proceeding, what do you make of the larger issue of estoppel? I mean, I'm thinking now of 3731E, which basically says you can't disown any prior proceeding criminally in a civil proceeding that involves admission to an element of the offense. If ownership's not an element, it seems all of the requisite admissions are here.
I believe that provision of the False Claims Act talks about the same transactions. However, I haven't seen, and I'm not going to suggest that my research is as compelling and as thorough as the court's, but I haven't seen cases where one is sort of charged with non-specific, one is convicted of non-specific actions that are then later alleged in the civil complaint, and that's where the collateral estoppel applies. Here, where you're talking about an eight-year scheme to defraud, where you can be culpable from a criminal perspective for doing one minor thing. I don't believe that the doctrine of collateral estoppel, whether it be common law collateral estoppel or what I think is even more narrow, the statutory collateral estoppel, I believe, is more narrow than the common law collateral estoppel.
Well, except for the purposes of argument that we were going to say, okay, that's true, she's not collaterally estopped. Help us with your argument that somehow ownership is relevant here. I thought the False Claims Act had three elements. You present or cause to be presented to an agent of the United States a claim for payment. That claim is false. That there's a false or fraudulent aspect to it, and that the defendant knew it was false and fraudulent at the time. How does ownership get into there?
Your Honor, and again, the issue was briefed by predecessor counsel. I looked it over and felt that the briefing was sufficient on that, but it was my understanding that with respect to the nature of a violation that relates to the false representation concerning whether sufficient supervisory by medical supervision by a medical doctor was in play, that the that ownership and being the person responsible for submitting that. The problem is the plea colloquy does not articulate what Ms. Patel did with respect to the heart, with respect to bioscience and its submission of what I'll call falsity relating to unsupervised testing. It speaks
at this point. It sounds like you're attacking the underlying plea colloquy itself and saying there wasn't a valid basis for a plea.
No, well, we are actually in another matter. The plea colloquy is being attacked, but that's beside the point. For purposes here, we have a plea colloquy.
Yeah, it can't be beside the point because we've got pretty clear law that says you're not allowed to do that. You can't come in collaterally attacking an after the fact.
And that's why I said in another forum we are attacking, but it's beside the point for this matter because I'm stuck with the plea colloquy in this case. I acknowledge that. That's what I was about to say. But the plea colloquy for a scheme to defraud offense is a lot
different. Saying I'm not attacking it, but you are attacking it. In the very next words you're about to say, I mean, I could see them coming out of your mouth like there's a little word balloon. She didn't say she was owner. But if she being an owner is not a piece of what you have to plead to in order to be guilty, who cares?
Because, and for purposes of the plea colloquy, you know, accomplice liability being something other than an owner may be sufficient. For purposes of that, that same theory of liability doesn't necessarily translate easily over to the False Claims Act.
Okay, so what's your law? Maybe I should ask it this way. If you're wrong that ownership is important in this civil context, is that the end of it for you? I mean, is that what you're hanging your hat on?
That's one of the primary issues in the case. Plus, the fact is that the record does not establish that all of the $1.1 million was not done under some level of supervision.
Well, we just read that question, right?
Yes.
Where she says you were paid this amount and this was all. I guess we're getting back now into a circle. You're going to say that that's ambiguous because of something that was said earlier, right? I mean, you'd acknowledge at least that that sentence and that answer standing on their own do not appear ambiguous, do they? It's only if we buy your argument that somehow ambiguity gets imported from elsewhere in the colloquy that there's an ambiguity.
In a vacuum, that question does not appear ambiguous.
Well, perhaps put it in a more general context. Aren't you really trying to get out of the dollar figure?
Yes.
I mean, it's not the
truth. We're not trying to get out. We're trying to get out of a summary judgment grant of a dollar figure. We're not suggesting that there's not some degree of liability here.
Only for Hart Solutions is what you're saying.
For Ms. Patel and for Hart Solutions, that's correct.
Judge Roth, I think you had a question about the certification.
Yeah, on the issue of when there was a neurologist, the clerk's office sent out a memo the other day requesting that you be prepared to argue the question that, can you create an issue of fact by a statement as a statement when alleging there was a neurologist from such and such a date to such and such a date? Statement is not sworn, is not made under penalty of perjury. There is considerable case law, no precedential case from this circuit, but nevertheless from other circuits, that is insufficient to create an issue of law.
Several points on that, and that is the last letter that came from the court, and I did spend a lot of time since then looking at that. I see my time might be up, but I'm happy to get.
Please.
Okay.
Please answer.
First, with respect to the notion of precedent, there seems to have been two cases and the only two cases that were reported Court of Appeals decisions. One of them was the Fifth Circuit case that predates the 2010 amendments to Rule 56. The other one, the In Re World Trade Tower litigation, actually was a direct violation of a court order, a discovery order, where the court said, you have to say something under oath or else. They didn't submit something that met the requirements of 1746, and hence the case was dismissed for that violation. There is no reported authority that suggests And especially in this circuit, that suggested a statement has to have a perjury jurat associated with it. Rule 56 itself suggests, although the comments talk about 1746 and unsworn declarations, the rule itself suggests that the statement has to be something that the individual has firsthand knowledge about, would be in a position to testify, would be admissible if accepted, and so forth and so on. And with respect to that, I would direct your attention, and here's something as I said, Rule 56 talks about affidavits and declarations, and if you look at the comments, one might say, well, the declaration they're referring to is an unsworn declaration under 1746. The problem is the district court rules in New Jersey talk about something called certifications and documents that comply with the provisions of 1746.
Well, the local rules in New Jersey couldn't overrule the important impact of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, right?
And I understand that, sir, and I would
if we read and understand Rule 56 to require an affidavit, which in common parlance means something that you've sworn under oath, or a declaration of the sort that complies with Section 1746, if that's what we understand it to mean, what difference does it make what the that the local rules might use the word certification.
If that's what the court understands it to mean and the court were to decide that, then the court would be issuing precedents for the world to follow for going forward. In this case, first of all, there was the rule actually provides an opportunity and a requirement that if something isn't sufficient for purposes of summary judgment determination, the other party object. That would be, I guess, 56C2. There was no objection here. There was a claim that these were sham affidavits, but that there was no objection that it was procedurally deficient, which then it could have been cured. The reality of it is that document seems to comply very much with exactly what the local rules suggest. And I understand the local rules are trumped by the rule itself. But the rule itself, on the face of the rule, is mildly unclear. The comment does refer to 1746. And in all fairness to this court, there is a fairly recent unreported decision, I think authored by Judge Ambrose, in which there's some dicta that might suggest.
And there's probably an unreported decision me, but.
There's one by this judge right here. There's one by Judge Stapleton. There's one by Judge Hardiman. There's a whole lot of unreported. So maybe.
And when you say you could find no other cases, there are other reported cases from other circuits, like File versus Rogers, Seventh Circuit case. Affidavits are admissible in summary judgment proceedings if they are made under penalty of perjury. Only unsworn documents purporting to be affidavits may be rejected. Now, that's dictum, but nevertheless, when you say there are no other cases, that's not true.
Your Honor, I apologize for having missed that case then. I spent a lot of time looking at this, paying close attention to what the law was in this circuit, and I looked and traced the Fifth Circuit case that the court asked us to take a look at. But again, as I see this, and what's interesting is all of the parties treated this, I mean, it's actually referred to as a sworn affidavit. I don't know where that came from in the pleadings.
I don't know either.
But it just seems that there is a practice that I think emanates from practicing in New Jersey where this, quote, certification, I don't know what a certification is, to be perfectly candid with the court, although it seems to be a common practice and parlance that's used in New Jersey all the time.
When
you are dealing with what is claimed to be false representations, and you have an affidavit attempting to counter those false representations, if that's not made under pain of perjury, it gives me great pause to consider that it should be taken under consideration, because if the claim of falsity is true in the first place, I think the claim that there is no falsity must be made under penalty of perjury if we're going to really trust what is being presented to the court.
And I understand the court's concerns, and that's the concern that is echoed in all the courts that have addressed this issue. My point here is that there was an opportunity and a protocol to say, wait, that document is not sufficient. The district court didn't say it's not sufficient because it didn't comply or have 1746 language. The government didn't object to it on that basis. Everybody just referred to it as a, quote, sham affidavit, which is sort of a different concept, which really doesn't apply here because you're certainly allowed to tweak ambiguous statements. And that's what that statement really is. The particular document, which is the certification of Curtis Patel, has all of the indicia of reliability that would one might ask in or expect in a declaration under 1746, except for the language.
That's a kind of a major exception, right?
Well, isn't the word sham, isn't that fairly a word for false or fabricated? When the district court judge says a sham affidavit, isn't he implying a certain level of disbelief?
Yes, with the sham affidavit doctrine, and until I started looking at this, I didn't realize there was such a deeply considered doctrine. The sham affidavit doctrine says, you know, if you say something very clearly and precisely, and then at some later point for a purpose that's in your interest to say something different, you say something different, we can disregard that. The context of what's being said here is really an explanation of two what I would suggest are ambiguous points in the plea colloquy. I don't think they're direct contradictions. I mean, you know, one goes to the ownership issue and the other goes to the period of time for which there was a supervising doctor. And I don't think that those were, I don't think that they're direct contradictions and hence, quote, would even qualify under the sham doctrine exception.
If we were to accept, even if we were to accept the certification on its face, where does Mr. Patel say that there was, in fact, supervision going on?
Well, the declaration says that he had a doctor.
The declaration says that that Dr. Tinkelman agreed to serve as the testing supervisor, and it says that Mr. Patel sent him compensation for serving as the supervisor, but I look in vain for anything that says he actually did any supervising.
Well, I think one can infer from he served as a supervisor. I mean, let me pull the exact language because again, sir,
I'll quote it for you. It's paragraph 4 from DA 34. I was introduced to Brad Tinkelman, MD, through a mutual friend, Rob Levin. Dr. Tinkelman agreed to serve as BioSounds neurological testing supervisor. So there's a statement that says he agreed to serve. If we're trying to be precise, as you're demanding with respect to the plea colloquy, I don't see anything there that says he actually served and did anything.
With all due respect, I think if someone says they agree to serve in the context of this, one can infer that they did. I mean, we're talking at the summary judgment stage here, where whether this is an issue to be disputed. I mean, that's really where we are.
Right. And wouldn't you expect if somebody was going to raise an issue of fact that they would raise it precisely by saying, I hired Dr. Tinkelman, and he actually did the work, and not say, well, Dr. Tinkelman agreed he would do something, but not say anything that he actually did.
I would have expected that many things that were done before the district court and before this court were done would have been done differently. I'm stuck with this record just as the court is. But I agree that statement could have been more specifically articulated. I don't necessarily.
My husband often agreed to get rid of his old neckties, but he very seldom did.
Well, I understand that. Yeah, I appreciate that, Judge Ruff.
There you are. All right. Well, we'll have you back on rebuttal, Mr. Drum. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Graybaum.
Your Honors, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Charles Graybaum. I represent the United States, the appellee in this matter. The court asked the parties to address two issues. Both of them go to damages. And for the record, the government is also asking the court to affirm the district court on liability. That's really the ownership issue, and I will get to liability if there's time. The court asked the parties to address the issue of Kirtish Patel's certification. We went through this and discussed already what the certification said and what it didn't say. And you asked us to look at both those two cases, the Klein case and the World Trade Center disaster litigation case. Both of those cases make clear that if you have an unsworn document, it's not under penalty of perjury, it didn't use the words true and correct, it can't defeat summary judgment.
Why don't you meet Mr. Cedrone's point head on? He says there was an opportunity for you to raise that as a problem, and if you had raised a technical issue like that as a problem, it could have been addressed, and there would have been, you know, the language of 1746 affixed without a problem. But nobody raised it, so it's not really fair for the case to turn on that at this point. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, the government didn't raise it, and it wasn't raised in the district court by anyone. One thing I'll say, though, is that where it says, he mentioned that there's some language somewhere where someone refers to it as a sworn affidavit. I believe that was Nita Patel's previous attorney who referred to it as a sworn affidavit. But the reality is, we didn't raise it. What we did say about that affidavit is that it really is a sham because it conflicted with his plea testimony. And that's really what we focused on, and that's what the district court accepted. In hindsight, we could have raised the issue and said it wasn't under penalty of perjury. He had every incentive to get it right because he was facing a monetary judgment in the Civil False Claims Act case, but we didn't raise it. The reason we argue that it's a sham affidavit is because when he pled in the when he took his plea, and I'm quoting now really from the district court below, he said, the district court writes, both admitted that between 2006 and 2014, so we've got the years there, they falsely represented to Medicare, and then he goes through what the falsities were about the neurological testing and this other scheme. And so the district court's point is that they said the, he said the exact years when he did his plea colloquy, and then he puts in an affidavit that says, well, actually, for some of those years, we really didn't have, we really had supervision. But, and our point in saying it was a sham.
The assertion is from the briefing that it doesn't, it's not specific enough that it, that if the court had meant to say for all those years and all periods or something like that, it could have said it, but it didn't say it. And so it left some ambiguity in the record. That's what I understand them to be saying.
That's what I believe that is what they were saying. And our point is simply that the court gave the specific years, and the response to that question was an unambiguous yes. And then he puts in a certification that is unsworn and is unsigned, where he says, actually, that's not really true because we did have supervision during some of those years. But our other point about the whole issue, of, because the second question that the court asked was whether there's really a genuine dispute of a material fact. And part of what we're saying here is there's no genuine dispute for the reasons that I've just said, because whether you consider the certification is just shouldn't be considered competent evidence, or whether you agree with the district court that it's just a sham, it doesn't raise a genuine dispute of fact.
Because
he's basically, well, we think there's no dispute because the affidavit's a sham, but we think more, the government argues more importantly, it's not material, that even if there is a dispute, it's not material, because when Nita Patel pled, part of what they're saying here is that the plea colloquy was ambiguous, and it wasn't clear if the judge was talking about some of the time or all of the time.
Right.
Even if you read every inference in her favor, that she thought she was just pleading that at least in certain periods there was no supervision, when she gets to the end of the colloquy and the court says to her, and so the unsupervised number, and then for the other scheme, which is not an issue, is that 1.66 million, she says yes. So
right, and I understand Mr. Cedrone to be saying it's not fair to view that in isolation, that somehow the earlier ambiguity infects that. What's your response?
Well, I think what my response is that even giving her the benefit that that earlier ambiguity, even resolving that in her favor, that she just thought she was talking about was at least some of the testing unsupervised, mm-hmm. even if you give it in her favor, what that really means when she got to the end of that colloquy and the judge put that very pointed question in front of her about unsupervised tests and put a number in front of her and she said yes, even if you view it in her favor, what she was saying at the end of that was, yes, for those tests that were unsupervised, and I'm, you know, she's saying, I'm only talking about certain periods, I'm not talking about all periods, but at the end of that colloquy, there's this very unambiguous question where she says, yes, for the unsupervised tests, this is the number. So even if you give her every inference and every benefit you can give her that she didn't understand the previous questions, she's not challenging that final question. She didn't say, I didn't know what unsupervised meant, or however it was phrased. That's the one question she really doesn't challenge, and she doesn't say that particular question is unambiguous, is ambiguous. And so I believe if you read everything in the light most favorable to her, even if you agree with her that she's saying that I thought this was just the number that was backing out the supervised tests, she still is stuck with that number. And that's why even if there's a dispute about supervision, it can't be a material dispute.
I'd like to go back. You make the argument at one point in the brief that liability is an issue that can be separated from the issue of ownership. And I understand the point of the argument, but does that answer the question of the amount of money involved? In other words, can you separate the issue of ownership from the, what is it, the $1.6 million figure that we're talking about?
Well, the ownership certainly does go to liability. And certainly if she's, if somehow she's not liable because she wasn't an owner, which certainly the judge, the government disagrees with that proposition. But obviously if she gets away on liability, then I suppose it just means that it's her husband and only her husband. It's stuck with that damages number. But the point about ownership, which was discussed before, that does go directly to liability. And on that issue, the government's point has been consistent that it's simply not, that simply can't create a material dispute. There's nothing material about liability.
Nothing that, material about ownership because it's not an element? Is that what you're saying?
Ownership is not an element of the False Claims Act. You have all kinds of people and all kinds of companies that are found liable under the False Claims Act without being an owner of the company. You have other things that you have to be liable for. You have to be knowingly submitting these claims, and you have, they have to be false claims. But she did, in her plea allocution, she allocated to those things, that she made false, knowingly made false statements to the Medicare program, that she submitted these false claims to Medicare, and that she and her husband were paid a certain amount by Medicare. So,
okay, stop for just a minute. Now, if you had to deal with this case, you were sitting up here, and take out the one question which we've questioned Mr. Cedrone about and which you are focused on now, that summing up question at the close of the colloquy. How would you deal with the issue of estoppel? Because it's not the case, is it, that she pled guilty in a way that locked her into every element of a False Claims Act damages allegation, is it?
Well, the government's position on estoppel is certainly from a standpoint of her liability for those.
Assume we were with you on that.
Now you're going to damages.
We're just on damages. There's no nothing in the plea colloquy that would prevent somebody. She's not stopped from coming in and saying, yeah, yeah, I pled guilty to the crime, but not to that whole number.
And that is correct. The government's, it's not the government's case that she is stopped from challenging that number. The government's case is simply that on summary judgment, even if you give her all the inferences that she's asking for, she's still stuck with that number from a, just from a
because
factual standpoint.
Because of the question.
She's stuck with that number because even if she's right, that all she was thinking in her mind was, I'm just pleading that during certain periods there was no supervision. At the very end of it, when the judge says to her, and so for the unsupervised tests,
Right.
She says
it
that number.
It comes down to that question. That's why I said leave that question aside. If you didn't have that question, you couldn't be in here arguing there's no issue of material fact, or at least you couldn't do it on the basis of some kind of an assertion of collateral estoppel, because collateral estoppel just doesn't apply in when we're talking about the damages piece, correct?
Correct. So it is not the government's case that collateral estoppel applies in a plea allocution to damages. And if we didn't have that number, then that's correct. There's nothing else in the record that would give the damages amount. That is correct. So what the government is arguing is that we do have that number and we do have her testimony. And even if you give her the inference she's asking for, that number still leads to the idea that that's the number for unsupervised tests. So in her theory of the case, for the unsupervised tests, that's the number she's stuck with. What she's trying to say about backing out the supervised periods, that's baked into that number because she said that is the number for the unsupervised tests. So even if you give her every benefit of the inference that of what she was thinking when she said, yes, we didn't have supervision during certain years, she's still stuck with the fact that at the end of the day, she said that's the number for the unsupervised tests. So whether it's...
Right. Well, I was going to say, as a point of clarification, I understood Mr. Cedrone to say that the concept of aiding and abetting does not carry over into the civil iteration of the False Claims Act. Is that the case? It's not an area of my expertise.
Well, what we're saying here with her liability under the False Claims Act, it's not, I'm not sure if you call it aiding and abetting, but what we're saying is that her plea allocution on liability did make her directly responsible for the fraud.
On a joint venture theory or?
On the theory that she was actually the one who was made the false representations. She was the one who knowingly made those representations. She knew it was illegal. And those were things that she had every incentive to challenge the questions. I agree the damages number, she might not have had an incentive to challenge that, but she had every incentive to challenge the questions about liability because those were the things that were going to ultimately send her to jail. So if she felt there was ambiguity, that's the question that she should have challenged. And she didn't challenge those questions. And the other point I'd just make about...
Where does the responsibility for ambiguity lie, though? If there's ambiguity in this record, is it who gets the benefit of the ambiguity? Does the government get to say, like you just said, well, she should have spoken up if she thought that was ambiguous? Or when you're coming in and trying to hold somebody responsible on the civil side, and you've got the burden of proof, does the ambiguity cut against you, the government?
Well, I think when it comes to things where she is collaterally stopped from challenging, then I think the ambiguity is really an issue for her because she's collaterally stopped from challenging that.
But if there's a compound sentence that is confusing, she isn't collaterally stopped from challenging that. Isn't that the responsibility of the prosecution to say, hey, wait up, hold up, Your Honor. Could you simply re-ask that question, dividing it between each of the defendants rather than this complex compound question?
Well, the government's position is that the whole issue of ownership is, in any event, it's not material to her False Claims Act liability. So,
okay, but as to the criminal liability, if the judge asks a confusing question in the colloquy, the prosecution can't just sit on its hands and say, oh, boy, we've got them in ways you never even thought we'd get them by that.
No,
question.
No, certainly the government would not want to do that. That is entirely correct. The government would not want to get a conviction based on ambiguous questions. I don't believe that's what happened here.
Well, I mean, you have an ambiguous question and a compound question. Did you and your husband own and operate two corporations? And from that question, you can't tell who or both owned or operated which of the corporations. I think it's a very bad question. And I think if the government wants to question that question, that they should have done it back then. But I don't think we need to worry about it now because I think there's other elements that are more relevant to what we have to decide today.
And that's been the government's point, that the district court, the government didn't say ownership mattered to False Claims Act liability. The district court didn't say that it was necessary for False Claims Act liability. It's an issue that Nita Patel raised, and we're just trying to deal with it up here. But it was not essential.
Well, when the government says, well, we were never arguing that, I mean, you were arguing that it was a sham affidavit in part on the basis that you were saying everybody admitted these things in the colloquy, these things including being an owner and being responsible for Biosound, right? I mean, wasn't that part and parcel of the assertion that this affidavit should be ignored because it's a sham?
We did put it in there because it is certainly evidence of fraud, but it is certainly not necessary to the government's case.
So you won't let go, but you agree with me that it's not necessary?
I'm sorry?
You won't let go, but you agree with me that it's not necessary?
It's not necessary to the government's case. The government didn't argue that it was, and the district court didn't find that it was. And the other point I would make simply about ownership is that my understanding from Nita Patel's brief is that all she's really saying is, I was not a record owner. And that's a very carefully written phrase, which basically rules out all kinds of other things, like, for example, being a beneficial owner of something. It's a very narrow, lawyerly kind of phrase, which basically says, my name wasn't on the piece of paper. But it's a husband and wife operation, so I think things like beneficial ownership would really come into play in that kind of situation.
Okay.
I'm out of time. If there are any further questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Grabo.
Thank you.
Mr. Sagone, we'll hear your rebuttal.
Your Honor, and I want to apologize because I want to actually clarify or correct something that I said earlier, because earlier when I was... I assumed the court wanted to immediately address something else. I wasn't focused on the court's initial question. But even in a vacuum, this question is somewhat ambiguous, and here's why. And were your companies, two companies, Biosound and Medical, Biosound Medical Services and Heart Solutions, paid at least, and then the number is mentioned, by Medicare for claims submitted for diagnostic testing? This question does not eliminate the possibility that Heart Solutions could have received $1.
Well, now you're back to ownership, right?
Oh, yes, sir.
Okay. So if we disagree with you about ownership being important, your argument collapses, right?
It may collapse on liability, but it does not necessarily collapse on damages.
How so? Because I'm not following you.
Again, sir, as I understand the False Claims Act, on this particular theory, just because somebody – well, let me take a step back. With respect to the issue that was before Judge Wall taking the guilty plea, that he was establishing a factual basis for the elements of that offense. So helping, doing, you know, just knowing about something and doing one thing to further that could be sufficient. And many times facts are articulated.
Yeah, that's no disagreement with that. But let's focus back on what we're talking about here, which is the damages piece. I think we're, you know, let's stay away from ownership. I mean, stay away from liability and just focus on damages for a second, because here's the question. The question is, you know, we've read it. We don't have to reread it. But she acknowledges with a simple yes that $1.668 million and change was paid by Medicare for claims submitted that were never interpreted by a licensed physician and diagnostic neurological testing that was never supervised by a licensed neurologist. Okay?
Correct.
So she's acknowledged that that sum of money was associated with the unsupervised, or no supervision at all with respect to that.
That's correct.
All right. Where's the ambiguity in that?
The ambiguity is for which company, sir?
And why does that matter?
It matters because just because she knows something, it doesn't mean she's responsible for it. Just because she pled guilty
now,
to it.
Now you're back to liability, right? That's why I'm trying to get you not to focus on liability.
Okay,
focus on the damages. Okay. On the damages with respect to the number, it doesn't have any bearing at all, does it? She's admitted that that sum of money is the sum of money that's associated with the unsupervised work, correct? Yeah.
She has admitted that that is the sum of money that someone could be held liable for
right.
The unsupervised
indeed.
Work.
Indeed. Yes. So now you're on liability.
But isn't it true earlier in the plea colloquy, this is the one time the government awakes from slumber, is that the Judge Walls began by saying, and he gets the years wrong, between 2006 and 2008.
Yes.
The government says, no, you have it wrong, Your Honor. It's 2006 to 2014.
Yes.
The question that follows is limited to Biosound. So even when she always accepted the dollar from Heart Solutions, the question the judge then puts after being corrected is, the years, did you and your husband falsely represent to Medicare that the neurological testing being performed at Biosound was being supervised, et cetera? There was no mention of Heart Solutions in that question. She says yes, that she and her husband were responsible for what was done on behalf of Biosound with respect to the testing claim.
Yes, sir, and I thought that was for the $400,000 component of the case that's not being contested.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Strone. Thank you, Mr. Grable. We appreciate counsel's argument. We've got the matter under advisement, and we'll recess court.